thank you. Gosh, I'm so glad to be here again. It's such a gift. Thank you. And I want to acknowledge the Kanza people and the Kaw tribe that we're in the land of. And also, in way of acknowledgments, when I first came to the work of Wes Jackson, Wendell Berry, and the agrarians and the like, it was like in the midst of a great transformation personally from this very authoritarian evangelical upbringing. And these guys and women in the land were there for me and probably saved my life. And then I was teaching at NYU, and I, Journey of the Universe, Mary Evelyn Tucker and Brian Swim's work came out, and I started teaching that, and some of what I'm talking about, well, it was a result of conversation with students. And I'm also appreciating having license to try out some ideas on you all, because, like, who talks about ambiguity? It's like so many ways to look at it. And it's kind of a little crazy making. But one of the reasons, again, it's personal, is that coming from that kind of authoritarian, you know, colonizing, in trying to decolonize myself as I try to help decolonize the rest of the systems, that, you know, if you grow up where somebody is saying, because I said so, that's why, or, you know, they leap up because Carl Sagan is coming on Cosmos and turn off the television because you're not allowed to watch it, then ambiguity starts to have, like, a certain glimmer. So I'm, like, entertained, like, what that glimmer might mean. So anyway, I also, another title for this might be Hope's Genius, 10 Mirrors of Ambiguity. And I like this quote from The Mad Farmer of Wendell Berry's, give your approval to all you cannot understand. So we're going to go there. I am reclaiming also one old sense of the English word hope as a fruiting haven that sustains its inhabitants more so than surrounding areas. So let's imagine that such hopes are mapped by a source, the genius of the place, in Wes Jackson's terms. Let's suppose that human inhabitants, recognizing their ignorance, consult the genius to extend their knowledge of the ecosphere's creative mosaic to the utmost, in Confucian terms, as Wendell Berry talks about in his essay, The Way of Ignorance. They do this consultation in order to skillfully support their hopes. Hopes, supporting hopes, supporting hopes. These learners are on the way of ignorance. And that's a term that Berry uses that comes from a poem by T.S. Eliot's A Wasteland. The wayfarers on this journey are willing to face a terrible truth, one stressed by Jackson and his co-authors all in this room, that there has been a conceptual split between nature and culture, entitling the latter, that emerged with agriculture 10 or 12,000 years ago, and that this approach has bred multiple orders of domination-subordination relationships. When power goes only one way, that is abuse. And when one-way power fueled with fossil hydrocarbons, that abuse went high octane. And when power built roads and pipelines, high octane became an expensive, heavily guarded, hope-marring system. Symptoms of the heavily subsidized systemic abuse, as we all know, I'll go through it quickly, include global average loss of soil, fertility outpacing its self-renewal, extinction of biological diversity overtaking its generation, diminished abundance of many kinds of life forms, the eruption of others, including human populations worldwide, global climate change, revving extremes, including droughts, storms, and floods, also poisoned food webs in societies organized by ideas of racial superiority and class privilege that bake in economic and other health-related disparities. One of these injustices is that the subordinated suffer place troubles first and foremost, and those troubles, however, are infiltrating the whole ecosphere, and they're coming for everyone, ironically, beyond humans' control. So, what shall wayfarers do upon recognizing that this domineering mindset lays waste to their hopes that is undermines the work of the genius that keeps the holes of their selves, mind and body, fed. This pulse of hard truth beckons wayfarers to step into the whirlwinds and weedy voids that are the hurt geography of wild resistance. This move requires both humility and courage to work into the complex awareness of voices and forms and multiple senses of knowing and unknowing, of conflict and chorusing, the awareness of multiplicities itself is a potential antidote to the totalitarian drive of a single prospect. Rousing such awareness might lead towards healing gashes within and between human beings and without, including unsustaining, unsustainable agriculture. Wayfarers know this much. The ambition of the tyrant is not the way of the ecosphere genius, whose remainders of art signal a billions of years old legacy of fierce, unrelenting, fecund, diversity-making, regenerative force. So, amid ambiguity, what is the nature of creativity in this changing universe is a question entertained in Journey of the Universe by cosmologist Brian Swim and religion and ecology scholar Mary Evelyn Tucker. This story weaves many perspectives into a still unfolding, ancient, evolving cosmos. It represents Earth's ecosphere as a cosmic, alive creation and human beings as subspheres made of it. A shared genius, they highlight, has deeply threaded ambiguity throughout. A star exists by interplay of gravity and fusion. The explosive end of a vast star brings forth elements that form Earth. A fox is both predator and prey. Snow brings protection for the tunneling mouse and hunger for the hawk. The snow-thawing sun means exposure to the mouse and food for the hawk. A drop in wheat prices brings worry to the farmer. The baker gets an extra buck. The remnant prairie holds its breath. The wolf's howl brings fear to deer and rancher and relief to the willow and riverbank soil it holds, and self-renewal to the mountain as a whole. The hope of one is the waste of another. Listening in, my spine tingles. 20th century ecological writer Aldo Leopold, I had to bring him in, warned would-be wolf and prairie eliminators that, quote, too much safety seems to yield only danger in the long run. Such dangers are now written on the scapes of ecosphere Earth. That ambiguity is intrinsic seems to be a lesson the genius teaches, whether from the vantage of healthy forest or amid whirlwinds and weeds of ecosphere sickness. Human beings, then, have always belonged to a welter of tensions, manifest inside and outside the vials of our skins. Yet now the ecosphere's fierce, complex response to abuses is unusually threatening, a crisis. Perhaps it has never been harder nor easier to resist the fear and want impulse to control things and lean into ambiguity, and never more crucial, as Swim and Tucker urge. And it's never been, more widely crucial, I don't think. What does this mean for agriculture? If ambiguity belongs to, quote, nature's economy, as Jackson speaks of it, what might alternative modes of food getting be like? And might responding also reciprocally alter wayfarers' minds and reorder societies? If so, such a positive feedback loop between hopes and imagination collectively might redistribute power, thus decomposing the one-way terms of abuse. One of my biggest concerns, as I mentioned, is that throwing off one despotic system, we merely replace it with another imprisoning ideology. Thinking even bigger, widening local feedback loops, positive ones, into an interlinked ball of hoops might have mutually regenerative consequences for the whole ecosphere as one shared hope of hopes. We gotta think of it. Ambiguity's nature. But if ambiguity is mapped in by the genius of the place, what is the nature of ambiguity and how might we learn? Barry, again referencing Eliot, suggests wayfaring wisdom respects both the, quote, ever-renewing pattern and each moment's new and shocking valuation of all we have been. This ambiguous profession itself seems a good starting place. And within colonial culture, who has left a more thorough record of following this advice than 19th century British naturalist Charles Darwin? His theory of evolution by natural selection binds humans and all other beings as kin. This signals possible escapes from domination-submission dichotomous thinking. So far, however, his theory has been an insufficient deposer of supremacy as the traumas of colonization continue to rocket. There's more to Darwin's utmost knowledge, however, than his theory. Equally summoning, I'm going to suggest, is his self-documentation as a roving wayfarer who learns and learns to learn by immersing himself in various places. Famously, Darwin was absorbed by smelling, seeing, hearing, feeling, and tasting. He traced cause and effect and correlations and other relationships. He reasoned cautiously by testing his impressions. He had an experimental habit of mind. This man did not rest with the whole status quo. He navigated disagreeing values, voiced opinions, chose metaphors, paused to wonder and play, made and admitted mistakes, tried self-correction, and generated fresh questions. As he interacted then, what did Darwin's encounters and interactions have to say, maybe, about ambiguity's nature? And is there any evidence that those encounters, in turn, extended his mind? As I read some of Darwin's work and with students, 10 facets of ambiguity became salient, strangely. I don't know, they just did. There are, of course, many ways to imagine ambiguity involving the facets themselves. I'm thinking of ambiguity something like this, and these facets. Each of the 10 facets is a mirror swinging from a wire as part of a sculpture mobile. And from where I'm standing, 3 of the shimmery mirrors seem to be outward facing, and 7 spin towards me or towards you. imagining abundances and limits of human perceptions. Taken together, these 10 glimmering mirrors of ambiguity paradoxically hint at what's beyond my head. Beyond words, to feel the existence of spaces to sink into that seep more sensibly into me, I feel the lack of a recipe and the fullness of the pleasure of not wanting any. I feel my grip loosening, freeing my hands to do other things, and making my brain happy too, apparently. I feel the present tense between future and past. I think without ambiguity, no hopes. I imagine hope is shifty. Its genius, that is, can be like a fox who makes seemingly unneeded tracks or rabbit trails, rabbity. And then I hear the words that recently a woman named Maida, who is a Tlingit shaman, advised a group I was lucky enough to be with. She said to us all, don't panic. Be always getting ready. Be always getting ready. So 10 mirrors of ambiguity. First one of the 3 that are outward glimmering. Chance. It could have happened otherwise. And here I draw from the German scholar Helga Nowotny's work, The Cunning of Uncertainty, which is a really interesting book. So, a grain in the balance, Darwin wrote, will determine which individuals shall live and which shall die, which variety or species shall increase in number, which shall decrease or finally become extinct. That was in Origin. A bird from North America might or might not have arrived in the Galapagos. In Understanding Change, post-Mendel, a gene mutation might or might not occur. Going way back, in fact, there might or might not have been this cosmos as it is at all. The universe might or might not have expanded as it has done. Chance is not the same as randomness, which Berry and Jackson discuss as a limit of perception rather than a verifiable condition. Chance, as eminent physicist Abraham, and I don't know how to pronounce his name, de Moivre, may, quote, neither be defined nor understood. Current scientists do their best, though, and they indicate that events unfold neither haphazardly nor in certain trajectories, but somewhere in between, that is, probabilistically. Quote from Berry and Eliot, the ever-renewing pattern and each moment's new and shocking. This means that the future is sure to be novel in patterned ways, yet what it will be cannot be precisely predicted. This is not only because of perceptual limits, but because, essentially, the future is contingent and not predictable. The future emerges, rather, out of the creative force, in Darwin's words, the genius of Jackson's, which continually bead and rebead the close of existence. Wildness, or the wills of selves, might be defined as the creative force of chance that self-tailors every garment and each bead stitched into it. It's the force that makes and remakes each nested sphere from the entire time, space, sunlit, windy, quaking earth to animals, soils, plants, seeds, cells, cell organelles, minerals, atomic particles, dark matter, systems. I started wondering, with regard to systems, if relationships have materiality, because that's when I think about systems, I think about that. So that's a question I have. Every event is like and unlike others, and might have been otherwise. No one knows what the future holds. So maybe here's a little thing to think about. If there is food and you're hungry, eat it. If your neighbor is hungry, share it. If there's extra, share more of it. Or save it and share it later. Two, blanks. The evidence has gone missing. Chance contributed to Darwin's understanding of why the geological evidence linking life forms over long periods of time was incomplete. The crust of the Earth with its embedded remains must not be looked at as a well-filled museum, he said, but as a poor collection made at hazard and rare intervals. The accumulation of fossils, Darwin explained, would have depended on an unusual concurrence of circumstances, including whether organisms fell where there was enough sediment to preserve them and whether those areas were disturbed by other geological events. Where chance did not allow preservation, quote, enormous blank intervals of time would occur in the record between successive stages of life forms. So too, a vanishing cloud leaves no trace, a bird song stops echoing, a footprint on the beach washes away, a murder weapon or pee tape might be torched, its ashes dispersed. No matter how perfect a memory or thorough a search, evidence of past conditions is full of holes. Histories are more or less complete. And here's another thing maybe to think about. When it's in your power to save things, like seeds for future generations, do it. Third mirror of ambiguity, mystery. Some things are not falsifiable. It has often been asserted, said Darwin, that variation under nature is a strictly limited quantity. To the contrary, he argued that that assertion is quite incapable of proof. What limit, he asked, can be put to this power acting during long ages, favoring the good and rejecting the bad? I can see no limit, he said, to this power. Darwin continued saying, there's no limit to this power in slowly and beautifully adapting each form to the most complex relations in life. In other words, the assertion of limited variation, like verifying randomness by the logic of hypothesis testing, is experimentally untestable because variation under nature cannot be contained nor reduced for observation. The hypothesis that species are immutable, on the other hand, can be tested, for example, by observing whether or not an interbreeding type of being can change in some shared characteristics over time. Darwin noted that domestic plant and animal breeders had shown this repeatedly. There's no evidence, however, to either support nor falsify the existence of an invisible, even tricky creator. Whether or not species are immutable, the existence of deity is a matter of faith, not science. Yet the creation, thought Darwin, seems to bring wayfarers somewhat nearer to that great fact, that mystery of mysteries, the first appearance of new beings on this earth. And so another thing to think about, mystery feels, to me anyway, like something to fear and praise. So maybe pray to the seeds, to our ancestors, and to future generations. Five. All right, inward glimmering mirrors. So this is the fourth of 10, and this is the first of the inward ones, but it's sort of on the boundary. Hide and seek. We can't perceive it yet. I don't know. This facet of ambiguity in particular seems mirrored on both inward and outward faces. It has commonalities with what Barry calls inherent ignorance. Hide and seek has as much to do with the vastness of everything, past, present, and future, as it does with, as Barry again puts it, the kind of mind we have, including all embodied senses by which human beings can know things. For instance, in The Voyage, Darwin catalogs numbers of botanical species collected from the Galapagos archipelago and where they occur. The data appear to confirm the hypothesis that different islands bear species unique to each. He added this caution: too much confidence must not be placed in the proportional results, as the small collections brought home, though in some respects confirming the results, plainly show that much remains to be done, much work remains to be done. This is also the kind of uncertainty important to statistical hypothesis testing. What quantity of data creates an acceptably low risk of mistaken conclusions? Darwin makes a habit of vigilance against presumption, Again, for example, in Origen, he urges, we are as yet profoundly ignorant of the ways species may get from one place to another. In terms of geological time, he stresses, the mind cannot possibly grasp the full meaning of the term 100 million years. It cannot add up and perceive the full effects of many slight variations accumulated during an almost infinite number of generations. The restricted capacity of human minds relative to everything predicts a great likelihood of never running out of things to learn. As Barry puts it, who but the ignorant would set out to extend their knowledge to the utmost? Who but the knowingly ignorant would know there is an utmost? Maybe to think about, gather more data all the time and keep good accounts. 5, inertia. We might not get around to it. With knowledge horizons moving continually beyond wayfarers' reach, even the most energetic seekers will not have enough wherewithal to entertain all of their curiosities. For example, Darwin mentions that he frequently observed small fly-eating lizards when watching anything nod their heads. But he concludes, I do not know for what purpose. He spent hours toying with these animals after tossing them in the ocean, apparently without ethical problems. Repeatedly, he hypothesized that their habit of returning to land was its historical lack of predators. He poked the lizards with a stick and pulled their tails. He noted their inclinations whether or not to fight back, yet he never did get around to the question of head nodding. He seemed okay with that. The boat is leaving. There's no funding. Obstacles, distractions, other priorities, and limited time may reorient seeking. Wayfarers must also rest and daydream. According to what cognitive scientists call the pleasure paradox, it may be enjoyable to leave things open-ended, to lift stones but leave what's underneath for someone else to find out, or not. And maybe think about passing the kernels of beer around. If you can get food near a swimming pond, you might also swim in it. Flexibility of mind, 6, the unwillingness or willingness to learn. The pleasure paradox is not the same as willful ignorance, which might be defined generally as a form of stubbornness or unadaptability. The willfully ignorant of colleagues especially frustrated Darwin. Despite detailed evidence, many gripped their long-held belief in the immutability of species rather than admit a genealogy of ever-changing ones. Paradoxically, Darwin's willfully ignorant colleagues held fast to their faith in special creation, but would not be convinced by traces of life forms leaving legible signs in the rock. Rather than admit new material evidence, these folks preferred, quote, unexplained difficulties, Darwin thought. Some eminent naturalists pressed new evidence into old wineskins until published allusions spilled out. Among reputed species, these people thought, some were real ones, and some were those that God created independently, but apparently no one could tell which was which. And Darwin said, the day will come when this will be given as a curious illustration of the blindness of preconceived opinion. Would that it did, or did more. On the other hand, Darwin praised a few naturalists with much flexibility of mind. These were willing to doubt their former understandings and to shift them. He put highest confidence in young and rising naturalists who will be able to view both sides of the question with impartiality, he said. Darwin urged activism by these people with flexible minds to spread their convictions. Darwin's complaints against that sort of willful ignorance that clamps down on faith over material verification overlaps with Barry's more detailed taxonomy of kinds of ignorance arising from what he calls weakness of character. These kinds, he points out, that originate in weakness of character include avoiding knowledge that feels unpleasantly threatening. They also include something like the reverse of the creationist perspective, which is positivism, as well as intellectual overconfidence. Finally, Barry presses critically that there is a dark art of inflicting ignorance by withholding or muddying information with mean intent, and by other forms of deceit. And there are, in Jackson's terms, quote, clever manipulators who sometimes with cultish powers exploit others, willful or otherwise, exploit others' ignorance. And I also think of abstraction as being demonic without particularities. So as Barry's Mad Farmer sings, don't put a window in your head and keep out of drawers. 7, naming. Things may be bounded and related in different ways. The whole of things may be grasped in part and or as a unity or not. That is, there are manifold ways of bounding, comparing, and calling out things. For example, Darwin's theory replaced the essence of species defined as immutable or special acts of creation with a genealogical perspective. Accordingly, species were merely successful groups that supplanted older relations of intermediate varieties. No, quote, line of demarcation could be drawn definitively between types that were continually adapting. Types perceived as different enough to class as species were more like frames of a still rolling film or a beater who keeps undoing a design and remaking it. Punctuating and naming groups along a continuum involves subjectivity. It can also be generative of groupings. Today there are upwards of 30 proposed species definitions. Darwin also frequently speculated, though he did so with hesitance. He also reasoned through inference, analogy, and metaphor. Darwin alleged generalities, for instance, as well as equivalence or correspondences of things. For example, through direct observation of a stowaway European mouse established in the Pampas, he inferred the likelihood or similar cause for a newly discovered Chatham Island one. He claimed analogous aspects between two Galapagos and two European owls. Of great moment, Darwin, with explicit hedging, he said, analogy may be a deceitful guide, but he made his best guess when he said, based on observed commonalities among living things, he thought it likely that all Earth's beings had descended from, quote, one primordial form into which life was first breathed. Interestingly, recent psychological research indicates that analogy making as a mindset in particular can generate more relational thinking in other arenas. Darwin also imagined metaphors to make sense of the genealogical pattern of life's descent, a great tree and entangled bank, yet others, like Tennyson, calling forth and emphasizing nature red in tooth and claw, the competition in natural selection, has been used by some to justify eugenics. Calling things out from everything is an act of creative perception, perennial, annual, individual, community, environment, ecosphere, species, variety. Here's something to think about. Keep your vocabulary loose and flexible, maybe. Play word games while you're gleaning. 8, grace, integration of diverse parts. We cannot know the whole of which our minds are a part, says Barry again. Referring to inherent ignorance. He quotes poet Kathleen Raine to emphasize how, quote, the groundwork or knowledge we possess and unreliable memories consciously or unconsciously might affect our perceptions. Human minds, shaped from conception by parentage, culture, experience, and individual capacity and uniqueness, harbor some collection of memory, values, and ideas of how they should be expressed, which is a subset of some entirety. Different subsets orient human beings in the world differently. For example, Vice Admiral Fitzroy, captain of the HMS Beagle on which Darwin sailed, navigated by his European standing apart God's eye view of the planet, that is, in reference to the gridline abstraction of the prime meridian. Whereas centuries earlier, Maori ancestors guided their canoes by direct observations of the positions of stars all around them. Both groups arrived to the same shores of the same islands, although they named them differently, of course. Human beings can also learn varying habits of apperception, of habits, in other words, that orient new things to our inner norms. For example, on the one hand, the sight of black mud on Charles Island evoked the sort of fertility familiar to an Englishman, to Darwin. He thought that was pleasant, that nice dark soil. Compared with the parched soil of Peru and northern Chile. On the other hand, Darwin failed to align his first contact with so-called New Zealanders with his pre-existing ideals. He called them filthy, dirty, and offensive. Darwin made these evaluations 20 years before Origin was published as he was collecting the knowledge that built his theory. Perhaps his saving grace became practicing the same process of adaptation he was learning about. 20th century polymath Gregory Bateson defines this something like this as grace. Grace, he says, is the integration of the diverse parts of the mind, especially unconscious and conscious, also heart and reason, body and soul, and so on. This quality of integration, Bateson suggests, might be recognizable across cultures and species. It might be coded in dreams, might be best coded in dreams and artworks. Ones that say, here's what you might see. There are multiple ways of hearing this. There are diverse manners of being at home, rooted, but also nomadic and migratory. There are alternative ways of being humans. Some fail at grace, some succeed more or less. Deepening grace did seem to come to Darwin along the way of ignorance, thanks to hope, as Bateson defines hope. Hope, he says, is that value or quality of being that scientists or artists express, for example, anticipating the discovery of something amazing just beyond reach, that utmost again. Maybe the answer to a scientific question or a poem, maybe both, maybe some other happiness. The, quote, something amazing for Darwin was, after all, utmost knowledge of hopes themselves, in the fruiting haven sense, mapped by the genius of the place. Noting here, again, that one inhabitant's hope may be another's waste. Well, that sounds like integration. Grace. In any event, after decades of consultation, is it possible to say that Darwin's mind expanded, shifting his mode of apperception? He came at the conclusion of origin to the scientific understanding that all beings, including human ones, quote, belong to the same system. He also assimilated all beings into his moral circle, that of being ennobled. One might expect this to include New Zealanders and parched soils. Members of the whole he now imagined artfully as an entangled bank, clothed in singing from so simple a beginning, beautiful and most wonderful, endlessly making and remaking. So maybe express food getting as an art, including science, eat tastefully and practice grace with hopes. The last two mirrors of ambiguity, with these I submit that the previous ones are all contingent on my crazy perspective. Naivete. There are also unknown unknowns, the ones we don't know, we don't know. Donald Rumsfeld, as quoted in Jackson and Berry. One of my favorite anecdotes from Darwin's voyage is his realization that he lost important information when he'd mingled plant and animal collections from different islands. He hadn't labeled their unique locations. He said, I never dreamed that different islands close by with nearly identical conditions would be differently tenanted. It was only after another collector pointed it out that Darwin noticed what became cornerstone evidences of natural selection. For other reasons, maybe by luck, chance, or some intuition, Darwin had location notes for his flowering plants, and fortunately, he could sort out the mocking thrush species. He was, he said, astonished that each species was from a separate island. As Berry also notes, pertaining to inherent ignorance again, not knowing what we don't know also applies to the past. Forgetting leaves blank spots in human memories, the inward-facing doppelganger of the outward-facing matter of blanks in the material record. So maybe more heads are better than one, or on the other hand, maybe it's worse, come to think of it. So I like this quote from Milan Kundera, the Czech novelist. He wrote this book called The Art of the Novel. I keep going back to rereading and rereading it. Anyway, he just quotes an old Jewish proverb and says, I was forgetting that God laughs when he sees me thinking, so it's time to wrap up, and this is number 10. Ambiguity of ambiguity. Now, like, you know, if you're getting that meta, you're in trouble. Maybe we don't know why we don't know, and or more than one, there's more than one possible and or interacting factor. For example, is the unfalsifiability of a creator, God or gods, and or a purpose for existence due to inherent immateriality and unobservability, or some evidence collectively forgotten, or limits of human perception, or actual non-existence? Is there really no fossil evidence of various intermediate gradations of species, or does it exist but no one's yet chanced on it? Is that climate change denier willfully ignorant, or the victim of ignorance imposed by mean intent? Do I not see some still existing colonizer impulses in myself because I don't know what I don't know, and or because I haven't made the effort, and or because of a lack of grace? Is utmost knowledge enough to skillfully help heal the hopes that support humankind's and dissolve graceless agriculture. So the mirrors of ambiguity turn outward and in facing us, chance, blanks, and mystery, hide and seek, inertia and flexibility, naming and grace, naivete, ambiguity of ambiguity, tangled banks of mind and land, don't panic, be always getting ready, there is possibility.